This episode is provided by Thomas Allgaier and Frenis, based on the most relevant LinkedIn posts about go-to-market in calendar weeks 22 and 23. Frenis is a B2B market research partner helping ICT and tech providers identify niche channel partners by compressing the full journey from identification to qualified first meeting into 4 to 5 weeks. You can find more info in the description.
So imagine finding out that your company's highest paid new hire, like a top tier systems engineer, is actually just functioning as an expensive archaeologist.
An expensive archaeologist. I love that.
Right. Just spending all day digging through the minds of your sales reps, trying to figure out how your company actually sells.
Yeah, that's exactly what we're getting into today. Welcome to our latest deep dive. We are unpacking the top go-to-market trends from across LinkedIn over the last 2 weeks, and well, we're going straight past the buzzwords today.
Yeah, no fluff.
Exactly. We want to look at the actual mechanics of what's working right now because, you know, it's a really critical time to look at those mechanics.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you sift through the insights shared by B2B operators right now, you realize we are in the middle of this massive structural shift. Teams aren't just changing their tools anymore.
Right.
They are completely re-architecting how a revenue engine even runs.
And so our mission for this conversation is really just to cut through all the noise. I mean, we all know AI is the biggest buzzword in B2B right now.
Undeniably.
But frankly, if you're listening to this, you really don't need another lecture on why AI is the future. You know that. You need to know how high-performing teams are deploying it today without completely breaking their current pipeline.
Yeah, without blowing everything up. So let's get right into that structural shift. The conversation online has completely pivoted away from just, you know, buying software to this new concept of engineering systems.
All right, and there's a specific title attached to this now, the GTM engineer. Raul Sfat shared a data point that literally made me do a double take.
Oh, yeah.
He noted that the GTM engineer role has grown 13-fold. In just 20 months.
13-fold.
Yeah. I mean, a 13x increase, that isn't a trend. That is companies suddenly realizing they have a massive gap in their infrastructure.
It absolutely is. And, well, what's most revealing is how companies are actually valuing that gap. So Neil Vithlani recently analyzed nearly 200 job postings for GTM engineers.
Yeah.
Just to see what the market is actually paying for this skill set. And he found that the compensation is entirely bimodal. Like, there is no middle ground at all.
Wait, what does that mean in practice?
Well, you have one cluster of people making $200,000 working in-house, and then another cluster making maybe $2,000 a month running campaigns from overseas.
That is a massive gap.
Right. And the dividing line really comes down to mechanics. Are you just, you know, pushing buttons in a software tool somebody else built, or are you architecting the actual revenue system that the tool operates within?
Oh man, that distinction is everything right now. It's kind of like building a smart home, you know? Well, a lot of companies are rushing to hire an electrician to plug in a few smart bulbs, and they think, great, we're an AI-first company now.
Right, check in the box.
Exactly. But the people commanding those massive salaries, they're the architects. They are the ones designing the entire electrical grid from the ground up so that when you plug in a new piece of tech, the house doesn't just short circuit.
That analogy maps perfectly onto how Brandon Redlinger breaks down the reality of this role.
Oh, he had those three levels, right?
Yeah, he identified three distinct levels of GTM engineers out there right now. So at the 101 level, you have the workflow builder.
Okay.
This is the person just living inside the CRM asking, how do I automate this one specific task so my SDR saves 5 minutes?
Just basic efficiency stuff.
Exactly. Then you move up to the 201 level, the systems builder. They look across functions, so marketing, sales, customer success, and they ask how the data flows end to end.
Getting a bit more holistic.
Right. But those architects you mentioned, they sit at the 301 level. Redlinger calls them the revenue architect.
Revenue architect. That sounds expensive.
It is, because they're designing the underlying data infrastructure with AI orchestration baked in from day one. They're building a machine that basically adapts to market changes automatically.
Which is wild to think about. And to visualize what that 301 level actually looks like in practice, Shashank Chandrasekaran shared this concept of the GTM workstation of 2026.
Oh, the Kanban board thing?
Yeah. He says, we won't be hiring traditional massive go-to-market teams anymore. Instead, you build a localized workstation. He describes it like a Hermes Kanban board running right on your laptop.
Okay, so how does that work without a huge team?
So you have columns for every stage of your outbound motion, right? But instead of humans moving the deals, you just drop in cards and AI agents pick them up.
Wow.
Yeah. So one agent is tasked with sourcing the accounts, another qualifies them based on your proprietary criteria, another drafts the copy, and a human operator just sits above it all, supervising the board and managing the exceptions.
And if you think about the mechanics of making that Kanban board actually function, it explains exactly why that revenue architect is pulling a $200,000 salary.
Right, for sure.
Because you cannot just drop an autonomous AI agent into a messy, undocumented process and expect it to magically generate revenue. You have to design the logic, set the rules of engagement, map the data flows first.
Otherwise, the agent just executes bad strategy at light speed.
Exactly. Just doing the wrong things much, much faster.
But wait, I have to push back here for a second. Because a 13x growth in 20 months, that sounds a lot like panic hiring to me.
Oh, totally.
Like, if you're a VP of sales or a CMO listening to this, are you worried that companies are just sprinting blind into this? Are we just paying top dollar to engineer a bigger mess?
That is the exact risk. And Eva Christine Reeder called this out brilliantly. She warned that a lot of companies are hiring these advanced GTM engineers one step too early.
Too early in what sense?
Well, her argument is that if you haven't codified your go-to-market knowledge before the engineer arrives, things are going to stall immediately. I mean, think about it. If your winning sales process still lives entirely in the heads of your two best account executives, there's no logic to automate.
Right. The AI can't read their minds.
Exactly. So you bring in this highly paid systems builder, and as she put it, they just become an expensive archaeologist.
There's that phrase again.
Yes. They spend their first two quarters just digging through Slack messages, interviewing reps, trying to unearth the institutional knowledge that the team never bothered to write down.
Man, expensive archaeologist is such a visceral way to describe that failure. And honestly, digging through the minds of your sales reps is bad enough, but digging through a bloated tech stack is even worse.
Oh, without a doubt.
Which brings us to the operational reality teams are facing right now.
Yeah.
Because if your foundation is flawed, throwing more AI tools on top of it isn't a strategy. Lissy Magus came out with a very blunt assessment of this.
What does she say?
She declared that the 40-tool GTM stack is officially dead.
Wow, just dead.
Yep. The highest performing teams she's observing are actually ruthlessly subtracting tools right now. They're going deep on just 8 foundational essentials. So platforms like Notion, Slack, and Claude.
Which completely reverses the narrative we've been fed for, what, the last 5 years?
Oh, yeah, where buying another point solution was supposed to magically increase your pipeline.
Exactly. And Ion McGinnis analyzed this and made a really crucial distinction. He noted that most teams today do not actually have a pipeline problem.
Okay. Then what do they have?
They have a leak problem.
A leak problem.
Yeah. So if your ideal customer profile definition is fuzzy, or your speed to lead routing takes hours instead of minutes, you're just bleeding opportunities. Buying a 41st tool to dump more leads into a leaky bucket doesn't fix the bucket.
No, of course not.
Yeah.
Let's talk about what those leaks actually look like mechanically, because Saranya Roy pointed out something that I think will hit really close to home for a lot of listeners. Your go-to-market system rarely breaks down in the big, obvious moments. Like, it doesn't usually fail during the formal handoff from marketing to sales.
Right. That's usually documented.
Exactly. It breaks in the tiny, completely unowned handoffs.
Yeah.
It's a mid-quarter territory revision where a list of accounts just gets orphaned.
Oh, that happens all the time.
Or it's a quick, undocumented patch someone makes in Salesforce on a Friday afternoon that quietly breaks all your lead routing rules. Over time, all those tiny patches create this shadow system that just drags your entire revenue engine to a halt.
Which really requires a fundamental shift in how leadership views operations. Rosalind Santalena provided a very necessary reality check for RevOps leaders on this.
What was her take?
She said, your tech stack is a symptom, not a strategy. If your pipeline is stalling, buying the newest AI sales engagement platform will not solve the underlying dysfunction.
You're just giving your dysfunction a faster engine.
Exactly. And Zilshaw actually noticed this exact dynamic playing out at a recent GTM meetup. Yeah, he said everyone in the room wanted to talk about advanced AI workflows and automated outbound sequencing. But he pointed out that almost none of the issues these teams were facing were actually automation problems.
They were process problems.
Right. Foundational data infrastructure issues.
Mm-hmm.
If you have terrible signal quality or your email deliverability is completely shot, the smartest language model in the world is still going to fail.
Yeah, I struggle with this next point, though, because everyone is selling AI as the ultimate solution to literally everything. But Anna Ersin suggested something highly contrarian.
I saw that.
She argues that despite all the hype, Your core GTM system should remain 95% deterministic and manual until they are absolutely proven to work.
Yes.
But how does a deterministic system even survive when the whole industry is pushing probabilistic large language models? Like, how do you balance that in a real revenue engine?
Well, it comes down to understanding the mechanics of how these models actually work. Let's use an analogy. A deterministic system is like a train on a track. It runs on hard, rule-based logic. You know, if X happens, do Y. You know exactly where the train is going to end up every single time.
Very safe.
Exactly. An LLM, on the other hand, is probabilistic. It is essentially an off-road vehicle. It analyzes the terrain and guesses the next best move.
Right.
Now, that off-road vehicle might find a brilliant, faster route to the destination, but without guardrails, it might also drive straight off a cliff by hallucinating an offer to a client that doesn't even exist.
Right. Totally going off the rails.
So Ersin's point is that you use the off-road vehicle, the AI, to ideate, to draft content, to accelerate research.
Right.
But the underlying track, the routing, the data compliance, the core logic that has to remain deterministic.
That makes total sense. You need human-built tracks to keep the machine going in the right direction. And Mudgy Avoja had a really sharp critique related to this.
What'd she say?
She noted that when companies abandon those human tracks and just let AI run wild, you end up with what she calls AI slop.
Ugh, AI slop. Perfect term for it.
Right. She sees all these 2026 GTM strategies that have this impressive technical structure, but absolutely zero conviction. The messaging just sounds like every other vanilla AI tool on the market.
Because it's written by the same models.
Exactly.
Yeah.
To fix that, you don't need to write a better prompt. You need human brains to pick the strategic beachhead and actually shape the proprietary point of view.
Yeah, and we really have to recognize that while we are obsessing over fixing these internal systems and, you know, cleaning up our data, the external reality has shifted dramatically.
It's a completely different world out there.
It really is. You can engineer the perfect train track internally, but it is completely useless if the buyer is no longer waiting at the station.
That is exactly what we're seeing. The behavior of the B2B buyer has fundamentally changed, and it's just breaking the metrics we've relied on for a decade.
Yep.
Adam Schoenfeld brought up a brilliant mechanical reality of today's buyer. We could debate AI hype all day, but the fact is, buyers do not fill out forms anymore.
They really don't.
They don't download your gated 40-page ebooks. Half the time, the human buyer doesn't even read your website. Their AI agent does it for them.
Wow.
Think about that from a tracking perspective. A buyer tells their AI, go to these 5 vendor websites, extract their pricing models, and tell me which one integrates with our ERP.
Right. And when you map out the mechanics of that interaction, you see why traditional tracking completely falls apart. Kevin Payne highlighted this. He pointed out that MQL volume marketing qualified leads and email open rates have lost almost all their predictive power.
Because of the bots.
Exactly. If an AI agent hits your website, scrapes the pricing data in milliseconds, and leaves, it doesn't trigger a form fill. To your legacy software, that just looks like a bounce.
Even though they're actually evaluating you.
Right. In reality, you were just shortlisted for a massive deal. And the same goes for email. An AI assistant can open your cold outreach at machine speed just to scan and summarize it for the buyer.
Oh, so it triggers the tracking pixel.
Yes. Your SDR thinks they have a hot lead, but human eyes never actually saw the email.
Okay, so if the pixel is dead and the form fill is dead, what are we supposed to be measuring? Like, how does a marketing team prove they're actually doing anything?
Payne suggests we have to start measuring entirely new concepts. The first is answer share.
Answer share, like share of voice.
Kind of, but it's a shift from share of voice. When a buyer asks their AI model to compare vendors in your specific category, how often does your company actually show up in the output? Are you part of the AI's answer?
Oh, that's fascinating.
And the second metric is agent intervention rate. This measures how often a human actually steps in to correct, guide, or respond to an AI workflow.
Okay, makes sense.
Because if your AI SDR sends 500 emails before 9 a.m., that volume metric is totally meaningless. You only care about the moments where a human buyer intervened and actually engaged.
And if buyers are using AI to ruthlessly filter out the noise like that, it means their tolerance for risk and their tolerance for long, drawn-out sales cycles is just gone.
Completely gone.
Mark Roberge validated this. He recently met with 178 founders and GTM leaders in San Francisco, and the takeaway was incredibly clear. The era of the proof of concept is dead.
Really? Dead.
Yeah. Buyers today demand proof of outcome, They do not care about the technical feasibility of your tool anymore. They care about measurable business impact within the first 90 days.
That is a huge shift.
It is. He also noted that hyper-personalization is no longer a luxury. It's table stakes. If you cannot deliver a highly contextual market of one experience at scale, your outreach is just invisible.
And if you want to deliver that market of one experience, you have to find where the signal density of your buyers is highest. You have to know where they are actually leaving breadcrumbs.
Right, where are they hanging out?
Exactly. Sergey Grizzly analyzed over 200 data points to figure out where decision makers at $1 to $5 merit AR companies actually spend their research time, and LinkedIn emerged as the absolute undisputed winner.
Doesn't surprise me.
Yeah. Decision makers are spending roughly 47 minutes a day on the platform. But it's not just about reach, it's about context.
Mm-hmm.
They are consuming operator insights, watching how competitors position themselves, validating market shifts.
Right.
That 47 minutes is where professional context actually turns into pipeline.
So let's put this all together then. We have these incredibly sophisticated AI-driven, hyper-personalized systems that are targeting buyers exactly where they spend their time online.
Yep.
If you're a revenue leader looking at this setup, it is incredibly tempting to think, amazing, I have the ultimate automated engine. I can just press a button and scale my company globally.
Oh, but that is a dangerous assumption.
It is. It's crashing hard against market reality right now.
Because hyper-personalization inherently requires local context, which completely breaks the idea of global copy-paste. The human element still dictates the reality of the market, regardless of how good your routing rules are.
Absolutely. Alexandra Makartsova issued a really strong warning about this friction. She noted that trying to copy a European go-to-market strategy and paste it directly into the U.S. market is a recipe for burning budget and getting zero traction.
Oh, completely different worlds.
Yeah. A product narrative that crushes it in Berlin or Paris will often fall completely flat in America. U.S. buyers have a different mechanical expectation for software. They expect immediate clarity and incredibly fast time to value. If your messaging takes too long to get to the point, the U.S. buyer has already moved on.
And, you know, the friction works in the other direction as well. Rüdiger R. had a very blunt take on North American companies expanding into Europe.
What do you say?
He pointed out that starting your European expansion in the U.K. just because, you know, they speak English, is essentially executive laziness with a travel budget.
Wow. Tell us how you really feel.
Right. But he's right. The UK is not a shortcut to European product market fit. The European market is this complex architecture of different buying cultures, legal frameworks, trust signals.
It's not a monolith.
Exactly. A sales motion that closes deals in London does not automatically translate to Germany, France, or the Nordics.
Yeah.
You have to earn that market architecture, not just try to cover it from a laptop in London.
That brings up a really fascinating example from Katarina Ginting about expanding into Southeast Asia. She shared a story about a B2B company that spent 6 months meticulously translating their entire content library and blog into English specifically for the Southeast Asian market.
Okay, so 6 months of work.
6 months. Do you know how many inbound leads that translated content generated?
I'm guessing not many.
Zero. Literally zero. They called it ghost town marketing.
Wow.
Because in highly trust-based markets, enterprise software is not bought from translated corporate blogs. It is bought from local founders and faces that the buyers recognize and trust in their local feeds.
See, this exact dynamic is why Karina Ortega advocates for what she calls the 70-30 GTM playbook when expanding globally.
The 70-30 playbook? Let me guess how that breaks down.
Go for it.
So the 70% is the automated engine we've been talking about. And I'm guessing the 30% is just like translating the language for the local market.
It actually goes much deeper than just translation. It's about translating the trust signals.
Oh, interesting.
She shared this example of a smart glasses product launch. The physical kit, the technical specs, the baseline positioning on paper that was all identical globally. That is the 70%. It's the scalable core, your AI workflows, your foundational planning cadences. You build that once and run it on automation.
That makes sense.
But how that company actually showed up and built the narrative in Germany was fundamentally different from how they showed up in the Middle East. That is the 30%. It simply refuses to be copy-pasted.
Because of the cultural nuance.
Exactly. It requires experienced humans in the loop who understand those nuances and know exactly which local levers build trust. The entire goal of automating that 70% isn't to fire your humans.
Right.
It's to free up their cognitive bandwidth so they can focus obsessively on perfecting that local 30%.
That is a brilliant way to frame the relationship between AI and the human operator. You engineer the systems to handle the scale, so your humans have the energy to handle the trust.
Exact.
But that really brings us to the final piece of the puzzle here. You can have the perfect 70% automated system, and you can map out your 30% local strategy, but how do you actually capture that trust mechanically?
You do it through the words you use. Ivan Dmitrijevich shared a concept that ties this entire deep dive together beautifully. He calls it the buyer language bank.
The buyer language bank.
Yeah, he points out a really stark reality buyer. Buyers do not wake up in the morning thinking about your company's highly polished 2026 positioning narrative.
They really don't.
They wake up trying to figure out how not to look stupid in their next internal meeting.
Yes.
Yet what do most marketing teams do? They feed their highly engineered AI agents with generic persona notes and corporate jargon.
And when you feed generic corporate jargon into an LLM, the output is just vendor fog and machine speed. The AI strips out all the humanity, and you just sound like every other vendor on the internet.
Exactly. The best go-to-market strategy doesn't try to sound clever. It sounds recognizable. It captures the raw, unpolished language that the buyer actually uses when they are stressed, when they're talking about risk, and when they're feeling urgency.
If you are building an AI-native revenue engine, the fuel you put in that engine has to be real human language. So we want to turn this directly over to you, the listener. Think about your own messaging. Think about the prompts you are feeding into your tools right now, and ask yourself this final challenge. What is the exact raw, unpolished phrase your buyers use when they are stressed that your marketing team still refuses to say out loud?
That's a great question to leave them with.
If you enjoyed this episode, new episodes drop every 2 weeks. Also, check out our other editions on account-based marketing, field marketing, channel marketing, MarTech, social selling, and AI in B2B marketing.
Thanks for tuning in, everybody.
Take a hard look at your systems this week. Don't forget to hit subscribe, and we'll catch you on the next one.